This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about the cloud-connected car, able to read road signs or know in advance if the car ahead of you will be braking. What features would you like to see in your next car of the future? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. But first, when you think of space exploration, you think NASA, the European Space Agency, China, Russia, India, SpaceX, just to name a few. But one organization you don't usually think of is the United Nations. Well, that's about to change. The UN intends to launch its first space mission in 2021. Why? Maggie Kurth Baker is here to fill out that story and other selected short subjects in science. She's senior science writer for 538.com. She joins us from the NPR studios. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Why is the UN trying to mount a space mission?
Well, so this is a robotic mission. There's not going to be any people aboard, but it's really meant to allow countries that can't afford their own space program to do research in space. And this is a huge deal. You know, there are really big disparities in worldwide research resources. So you have people who, you know, everything from access to space, which is a big deal, but down to just basic stuff like access to reliable electricity. And this is an opportunity for science, for these scientists to do research that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do and bring the benefits of that R&D back to their own countries.
That means that the UN is paying for this.
Well, no, not exactly. The UN has gone into this partnership with Sierra Nevada, who is the company that makes this rocket ship called the Dream Chaser, which is kind of looks like a scaled down version of the space shuttle. And they are set up the system where all the different countries whose payloads are chosen are going to split the bill. Now, Sierra Nevada is going to give the poorer countries a price break, and the UN and Sierra Nevada are also looking for funders to help offset the costs further. So this would not be a free ride to space, but it would be a significantly cheaper ride to space.
Speaking of space, we all know that Elon Musk earlier has announced this week about sending people to Mars, but this is not just a few folks. He wants to colonize the planet, right?
Well, yeah. This is actually the same conference where the UN announcement was made at the International Astronautical Congress. And what Musk is proposing is sending colonists to Mars by 2024, which is a decade earlier than NASA projected that they'd be able to send anyone there. And it's an interesting plan because it relies on some really serious technological developments happening. You know, there's not a rocket currently in production that could even get humans to the moon, let alone Mars. So he's wanting to not just send people there, but also be able to send rockets back. And that's a whole other step up, even in technology. Elizabeth Lopato at The Verge actually pointed out that the speech of Musk's, you know, it was frankly a sales pitch. He's hoping to get these other people with deep pockets in to invest in his idea because it's going to be too expensive for SpaceX to just handle by itself.
Yeah, because he said it's going to take, what, 1,000 journeys back and forth to the planet?
Yeah, and with current technology, it would be something like $10 billion per person.
$10 billion, but he said I could bring it down to $500 million or $500,000 or something like that eventually.
Right, yeah, he thinks he can eventually get it down to $200,000 a person, but that involves some big technological leaps that are going to involve big money.
I think it was also telling when somebody asked him if he would go, he said, no, I want to stay home with my family because you have to be ready to die. The first people to go are going to die. Something like that.
Yeah.
So,
well, the first people that are going to go are probably going to just be stuck staying there for a while because we don't really have the technology yet to bring anyone back.
Yeah. You know what? Let's move on to the next topic because, you know, I try to watch what I eat, but it seems like anything can have a healthy label on it. The FDA is trying to change that. There's so many healthy labels on food. Are they really healthy products?
Right, yeah. So this is an interesting conundrum. So in 2015, Kind, which are the people that make those fruit and nut bars, got this official warning from the FDA for illegally using the word healthy on their packaging. And that's because healthy has an official definition. You know, it's something that the government has officially defined, and that definition includes the quality of being low in fat, which a nut bar is not low in fat. But Ian Kulgren from Politico points out, you know, a tub of fat-free pudding would pass this test. So you end up with this kind of weird dichotomy where something that we might colloquially think of as more healthy can't call itself healthy while pudding can. So the FDA is now in the process of reassessing that definition, and they're taking public comment and trying to figure out what healthy ought to be.
Yeah, because the definition of healthy, you know, certainly where food is concerned, it changes so often.
Right. And it also changes based on what you're wanting to do. I mean, is healthy about losing weight? Is healthy about processing? Does healthy have to be organic? You know, there are not just scientific, but there are also ideological questions bound up in this. And that's going to be something that's going to be pretty hard to work out. It's likely that whatever the definition is, it's not going to make everybody happy.
And so they're taking comments about what healthy should be, and then they will decide somehow what labels are. Hmm. All right, let's move to your final story, and it's a cutie. It's about a wayward manatee. What happened?
A wayward pregnant manatee.
Oh, well, even gets cuter.
So, manatees are these giant, lumbering, adorable sea cows, primarily thought of as being Floridians. But one started being spotted off the coast of Cape Cod this summer up in Massachusetts, and they recently caught her and found out that she's pregnant, and they're in the process of setting up a system to transport her back to Florida because manatees cannot live in water that is cooler than 68 degrees for very long, and the water is starting to cool off significantly in Massachusetts, so they had to catch her and take her home. I think this is really interesting because it's kind of part of a long tradition of animals, aquatic animals, ending up in places you don't expect them. There have been California gray whales spotted off the coast of Israel, among other things. And, you know, Massachusetts often gets plenty of tropical sharks showing up. And all of this is sort of extreme examples of migration patterns that these animals already have. You know, we often forget that manatees can travel as far north as the Carolinas on a pretty regular basis and will go all around the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico.
Cape Cod's a little further.
Cape Cod is a little further.
And global warming would come to my mind as the reason for this.
It's not absolutely certain that that is part of it right now, mainly just because this is kind of a one-off situation. It happened before in 2008, but there's not evidence that a lot of manatees are moving northward. It's more just that this one manatee managed to get further than anybody else did.
Well, hope we got some ice cream.
A manatee, Christopher Columbus.
Hope she got some ice cream while she was up there in Cape Cod.
Hopefully so.
Thank you, Maggie. Maggie Kurth-Baker is here with us. She's senior writer for 538.com. Good to see you again. We'll see you next time.
Nice to see you.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Well, you know how it is. You're out with friends or doing something cool and you want to capture the moment. So you pull out your phone, you frame the shot, and too late. The moment is gone forever. Well, what if instead you just tap the side of your head because you're already wearing a pair of sunglasses outfitted with a pair of cameras ready to capture a 10-second video anytime you just tap it? Well, the company Snapchat has rebranded itself as Snap Inc. and unveiled what it calls Snap Spectacles. Here to walk us through the good and bad of the gadget is Josh Constein, editor at large for TechCrunch. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so these are look like regular glasses, but with a couple of video cameras in them?
Yeah, so on one side of the frames, they'll have a video camera, and on the other side, there'll be a little warning light that'll show people that you're recording them, which is very important considering with, the last time that people tried face computers, Google Glass, there was no real clear indication that you were recording someone, and that made people very nervous around them.
Now, say, is this just supposed to be a big toy for us to use? Or is for work?
From one perspective, you could say it's a toy, something that people are just going to buy to use at music festivals and barbecues. It'll be about $130. And, you know, it's not going to be that important because you already have a camera in your phone. But from another perspective, you could see this as Snapchat trying to own the camera. Right now, it has to go through your iPhone or Android phone's camera, and it doesn't have nearly as much control over the experience. This way, it can build whatever type of camera it wants. So in this case, it's an 115-degree wide lens camera that actually records in circular video, a video format no one's ever seen before. That way, when you watch it on your phone, you can turn your phone in any directions, portrait or landscape, and it'll always be full screen.
All right, that's the good thing. What's the bad thing here?
I think the bad thing here is that people are not really used to having to suddenly be on camera. When we're in normal life, if you do something that's maybe a little bit risque or strange or weird looking, nobody's holding their camera up around you, you don't have to worry. Because if they do want to record you, they're going to have to pull out their phone or pull out their camera. And in those few seconds, you're going to have time to change your behavior. But with this, people will be wearing these glasses at all times. So all they have to do is quickly tap the side of the glasses and suddenly you're on camera. And that's going to be pretty nerve-wracking for some people. If you remember, there were bars and places that put up no Google Glass signs. And somebody even got punched in the face over wearing them because some people just don't want to be on camera.
Wow. So you'll see this is a very distinctive sunglasses. You can see who's wearing them. I guess you'll go hide or something if you see somebody coming in, if you don't like that.
I guess, but the sunglasses style for teens right now is very outlandish. They're covered with weird features all over them, strange little bumps and curves. And so it might not necessarily be instantly obvious that somebody is wearing these. But while Snapchat's younger teen users might have no problem with being on video, especially because when you're being recorded by Snapchat, it's usually going to disappear within a day of somebody posting it. It's not like somebody recording it forever on YouTube. But at the same time, older people, anyone who's exposed to this, is probably going to get pretty freaked out.
And what about, are they two cameras? Can you make a 3D picture out of the two cameras on the glasses? That would be terrific.
There's actually only one camera on the glasses right now, but down the line, Snapchat has paid a lot of money to hire a bunch of augmented reality experts, which it's using to add features to its normal app, like being able to stick an emoji to something and it move with that object no matter how your camera moves. And one day, Snapchat could definitely build augmented reality into these glasses so you could see stuff on the lenses rather than just being clear sunglasses lenses.
Well, give me those two cameras on the iPhone at each end so I can take a 3D picture, and I'm in with this stuff. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us, Josh. Josh Kunstein, editor-at-large for TechCrunch. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hit the road with a look at the connected car. What would you like it to do for you? This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's a lot of talk about self-driving cars these days. You've got Tesla, Google, other car companies are betting big on the future. And perhaps one day you can sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride as a robot takes on the traffic and the road rage. While fully autonomous cars are a few years off, our cars right now are packed with processing power. Vehicles are equipped with radar and LiDAR and video cameras. And this week at the Paris Motor Show, Audi, Mercedes, and BMW unveiled cars that can read road signs and determine the best route to avoid traffic. And they can even do one of the most dreaded driving tasks, finding a parking spot. Yeah, no more circling the block for you. Well, how can we tap into the tech to connect to other cars and the environment around us? What new driving features could all this stuff open up? And what might the Paris Motor Show look like in, let's say, 2026? My next guests are here to take us down that road. Josh Siegel is a postdoctoral associate in mechanical engineering at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Doug Newcomb is the president of the C3 Group. He's also a car technology journalist based out of Portland, Oregon. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to be here.
Welcome. I want to ask our listeners what they would like to see in a connected car of the future. Do you want more smart features in your car? What kinds of features would you like? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us, at SciFry. Josh, we have smart homes right now. Your fridge is all on. They can tell you when you're out of milk. What's the difference between connecting your home and connecting your car?
Well, there are a couple of key differences between connecting your home and connecting your vehicle. The biggest difference in my mind is that when you connect your home to the internet, you're choosing what data to put out there. You willingly buy a smart refrigerator. You willingly buy an intelligent thermostat or a connected door lock. If you look at cars, there's an incredible amount of information there. You might be looking at 100, 200, or 300 sensors in a vehicle. and there's this rich information generation, 25 gigabytes of data every hour. How do you know what to transmit? How do you know what you can do with that? Then there's also the issue of your vehicle moves, your house doesn't. So it poses challenges in terms of ensuring that your vehicle is able to remain connected, is able to share that data reliably. And then the security risks as well. It's one thing to leave your front door unlocked, but it's another thing entirely if you are able to wrest control of a vehicle that can go 100 miles per hour and weighs 3 tons.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these technical challenges, and you have these challenges in understanding what to do with the data, but you also have massive opportunity to improve people's lives, reducing commute time, improving fuel efficiency, improving safety, and so on.
We're seeing that already this week at the Paris Motor Show, right? They unveiled something called the HEAR system. It connects cars together so they can talk to each other. How does it do that?
So HEAR is a really interesting platform. And if you look at how telematics systems, basically systems connecting cars to the cloud, have worked previously, every manufacturer had their own system. They had their own silo where they got data from their vehicles and put it into their private cloud for their applications. The thing that makes HEAR different is that it collects information from multiple different makes and models of vehicles. So Audi, Mercedes, BMW, they're all sharing information from their sensors, from infrastructure, and putting it in one place. And this is one of the big challenges that we've seen with connected vehicles. For a lot of applications to work reliably, they need data density. And by allowing multiple manufacturers to share information in one place, they can grow this information more rapidly. An example would be, you mentioned radar and LiDAR. So these, for people who are unfamiliar with these technologies, they're range-finding technologies. And many cars on the road use them as part of over-the-horizon awareness or safety systems for adaptive cruise control. But you can also use this to determine when a parking space might be open as you drive by. And that Mercedes that just passed an open space might be able to tell the BMW that's a mile away that that space is open, and the BMW can route to it automatically.
Or 10 BMWs can...
Or 10.
Or 10 and fight over it when they get there. Doug, there are other systems and companies that are tackling the parking problem. How are they doing it differently from the HEAR people?
Well, one of the companies that's doing it is called Inrix. People know them as a traffic data company. But like Josh said, it really depends on having many of these cars out on the road, kind of hitting a critical mass. What Inrix is doing with parking is, and a lot of these things are in place, it's just a matter of tying them together. For example, Inrix is working with parking providers for off-street parking. So you're driving your Audi, or now they just introduced it for Mercedes-Benz. You can call it up on the in-dash infotainment system screen and say, oh, okay, I'm going to park at the airport. These are the number of spaces available at this particular lot. It even shows how much it's going to cost you. We haven't gotten to the point where you can actually pay for the parking, but that's coming really soon. And also Inrix, as Josh was talking about with Mercedes, Inrix is doing this with BMW, where as the cars, they're actually finding on-street parking, and they're using data analytics to figure that out. And another company, Bosch, showed something last year at the Consumer Electronics Show, where as cars are going by, they use their cameras and sensors to spot open spots on the street. So just to kind of give you an idea of how this technology and how this data is starting to come together, like you said, to just make it much easier to drive, which is, part of driving is finding a parking spot.
That's a big part. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to 844-724-8255. Let's go to Marty in Caldwell, Ohio. Hi, Marty. Marty, are
Hello.
You there? Hi there. Oh, must be on a cell phone.
Well, yeah.
Can hardly hear you. Like, we have to drop. Oh. Well, he's gone. He was asking about, I saw his question was, he wanted to get the chauffeur-driven car that comes when you whistle, sort of, Are we getting close to getting the car that will come when you need it by itself?
Yeah, in fact, Ford, just a couple of weeks ago, announced that they're going to have a self-driving ride-sharing vehicle available by 2021. So just in 5 years, and now Uber is actually doing that in Pittsburgh. They're testing autonomous taxis or Ubers. So yeah, I don't know about when you whistle. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of app for that. But basically, I think where it's going, and I think you'll see this a lot in urban areas, where you'll have these autonomous taxis that provide the service. And I think that's where we're going to see it first.
What about that?
Absolutely.
No, go ahead. Jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that this is a really good point because it brings up the shift in at least the American market from personal vehicle ownership to shared mobility. And that's where we see a lot of these things headed right now. So it may not be your car that you call or that you whistle to, but it may just be a car that comes to you. And connectivity is really key to enabling autonomous technologies in vehicles because one of the things that these vehicles do is they gather data wherever they go. So if we think about a vehicle as a big series of sensors driving around, we can use that information to build the type of maps that vehicles need to navigate themselves.
Yeah, well, you know, I use Waze all the time to find out what the road conditions are like. I imagine that kind of crowdsourcing is the kind of stuff
that you're talking about. That's a good example.
Doug, I know that automakers are looking at face recognition software. What would they do with face recognition software?
Well, a couple of different things. I've seen Volvo, for example, where they use face recognition in vehicles basically to make sure that the driver is not being distracted. As I think one of the issues we're going to see as we move to autonomy is the handoff, as it's called, between the driver and the car. And there's going to be certain instances where the driver needs to take over. So if you have cameras in the car that's watching the driver's eyes and can tell, and we have this technology now, Lexus had it, so if you're driving and you're looking away from the road for a certain amount of time, this infrared camera sees that and gives you a warning. And we're seeing it with other manufacturers as well. I mentioned Volvo, and it's getting more sophisticated as well. And another company, Continental, I saw they showed a example where, you know, we're now getting so many different alarms and things like that in the car, people get what they call alarm fatigue. So they came up with a system that kind of filters basically when people are looking away from the road, when they're really looking away from the road, and it gives you a very strong indication that, hey, you better turn your attention back to the road.
You know, being a car geek, I don't have enough dashboard information. I remember back in the day when you had oil pressure and temperature and all that kind of stuff, which is all gone. Is there a way to wirelessly let that show up on my smartphone or something sitting on the dashboard so I can see all that cool stuff that we used to?
Yeah, so that's actually coming back into vogue, I suppose. If you look at things like OnStar's application right now, there are also aftermarket telematic systems. So some prominent ones in the field would be Automatic or Vinly. And these plug into your diagnostic port. They connect to something called OBD2 or onboard diagnostics. And they'll let you see everything that's going on under the hood or under the floorboards, you know, because you can get analytics for your transmission and a number of other vehicle components as well.
Yeah. I want a graphical display like my old dials. Let's go to Don in Oakland, California. Hi, Don. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Glad to be on.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I was asking about rush hour and if there's a way a car could look and see what the fastest lane would be in the next mile or two.
Oh, yeah, you're in California, so you need to know that stuff.
Okay. And I'm always in the wrong lane.
Me too. I think that's one of we were talking about the HERE technology earlier. It's not only the car that's going to be connected, but all the parts of the car, the brakes, the windshield wipers, all these different things. So if they don't have that application yet, but I'm sure it's coming, where if a mile up the road, let's just say that there's an accident or someone stalls or whatever, you will know, you will get an instant, the cars ahead of you will tell you that, so you can start to move over, you know, so you're not caught in that bottleneck.
Yeah, or what toll booth lane to get into as you're getting
there you go.
Closer. I've heard that lots of infrastructure is becoming smart to connect to your phones and cars. There are smart billboards now. Do we have more smart infrastructure, Doug, coming online?
Yeah, we do. In fact, that's a big push. Last year, the U.S. Department of Transportation did a Smart City Challenge competition, $50 million grant they gave away. I know a lot of the cities were looking at making not only the cars connected, but the infrastructure connected. So, I mean, how many times have we sat at a traffic light when there's no one there? The cars in the traffic light can talk to one another, and then also to avoid accidents. If there's a car running a red light, then we you know, you can get a notice. But the billboards, I wrote about that in Europe. That's a little bit, it's kind of what Josh was saying, that's a little bit creepy. It basically will identify your car. Let's just say I pull up to the stoplight with this camera with a billboard, and they see I'm driving a BMW, and they say, "Oh, would you like to, you know about the latest BMW?" It doesn't grab information, personal information, but you know, it grabs enough information to say, "Hey, here's a guy with a BMW. He might want to buy the next one." So that's a little bit where it's still a little unclear.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking about the car of the future with Josh Siegel and Doug Newcomb. I almost called you Don Newcomb. Shows you my age. I talk about creepy. There's so much dashboard space. I can see that as a billboard spot someday in the future. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's go to Masood. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question about the safety of having all these electronics on board, because once we move to Internet of Things, we're going to have all the data that's being transferred, and they're definitely hackable. And would they cause any kind of safety hazard for the people who are on the road, for example, if someone could hack it and manage it, and what kind of problems that we might get into?
Good question. You know, today I heard some news about people worrying about the Internet of Things of their homes. There's thermostats and things like that being the entry point for hackers. Is this what we should worry about, too, with the cars? Hacking cars? People taking over your car? Josh, Doug?
So I think that we need to worry about it in terms of designing better systems in the future. If you look at how cars have been designed historically, there was very little attention paid to ensuring that these systems are secure and robust. Connectivity sort of is an emergent technology. It wasn't really planned when all these automotive architectures were put into place. So that said, hacking is a risk sort of local to the vehicle today. We haven't seen any exploits demonstrated at scale, but it's definitely an area of research, and there's a lot being done in terms of applying machine learning to intrusion detection and that sort of thing. And it's something that we'll need to continue to look at in the future. I believe last week the Department of Transportation posted some guidelines about how to secure vehicles and how to test these vehicles. So we're getting there slowly, but I don't think that we're there yet.
Mm-hmm. What about all the features you want to see, Doug, in a car of the future? One of the things that we all have tire pressure monitoring systems in our tires. Should we find some way of never getting a flat instead of just monitoring the... I know we have run flat tires now.
Right, right. Well, that's a good example of how all the pieces are in place, and this is something I would like to see. I mean, you know, we've all probably had the instance where you walk out of your office at 5 o'clock or what have you, and you have a flat tire. Well, there's no reason that tire pressure monitoring system, like Josh mentioned, a lot of automakers now have a remote app. You can lock the doors, you can start the engine. That tire pressure monitoring system should be able to tell the app that, hey, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 10 o'clock in the morning you have a flat, so you can call AAA or whomever. So that's an example of some of the benefits that this connectivity can have, and also an example of how all these pieces are in place. It's just a matter of tying it together.
Yeah, so your app signals your car is out of air in the parking lot. You know, I'm run out of time, but there's so much more I want to talk about. I'm imagining that your cell phone, your smartphone, is going to be an integral part of your car in the future, right? Unlocking the door, things like that.
It is. In fact, what's kind of happening, what Josh was mentioning about the security aspect, the same thing is happening in many ways with automotive, because you got to remember, automotive, their product life cycles or planning cycles are 4 years. So whatever vehicle they're planning now won't be out till 2020. So they have to be able to anticipate this. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to see more smartphone connectivity. You have these platforms called Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. You plug in your phone, you basically get the user interface from those devices in a safe way. in the dashboard. And they're also talking to give you an idea of, you know, not all cars are connected. Most people are. They have a smartphone in the car. How can we connect smartphones, for example, a smartphone in the car to talk to a smartphone in someone's pocket as they're walking across the street, pedestrian, so they don't get hit?
That's right.
So we're starting to see that as
Interesting
well.
Interesting point. Josh Siegel of MIT and Doug Newcomb of C3 Group, thank you for taking time to be with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with David McCauley right after this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Excuse me. I love to learn how things work. I don't care if it's the iPhone, the coffee maker, or the toilet tank, of which I have fixed quite a few. And that's why I'm so thankful for David McCauley, creator of the 1988 book, The Way Things Work. That seminal book in 400 pages offered us inquisitive tinkerers a hand-illustrated tour of the machines that fill our lives, from you got your simple lever to the distant Hubble telescope. But what happens when our machines change? How do you explain a smartphone in pictures, or an e-reader, or the new full-body scanners at the airport? Well, lucky for me, David McCauley has gone back to the drawing board, literally, and updated his book. And he's my guest today, illustrator most recently of The Way Things Work Now, out October 4th from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You might also remember some of his other visual guides, Castle, Pyramid, Cathedral, and The Way We Work, which was all about the human body. We have some gorgeous illustrations from the book on our website, including a quadcopter. So if you want to see the quadcopter, go to sciencefriday.com/quadcopter. And if you have any questions or stories about how these books informed your world, you can give us a call. Our number, 888-724-8255, 844-724-8255, and comment on Twitter via SciFry. David McCauley, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
You know, the way things work has been explaining the world since 1988. Was it a challenge to do an update?
It was a challenge to do the original. To do the update was comparatively simple in that there were fewer additions to the book, fewer machines that we're going to devices to include. But still a challenge. The challenge, more than anything, I think, had to do with the scale of the machinery that we were going to be talking about and the technology, and the need to maintain a consistent visual look so that the book still felt like a complete, you know, done at one sitting kind of a project.
Now, as someone who's been certainly drawing the world for decades and as a human being living in the world, how have you felt personally about the advances in technology? Welcome? Too much? You've now illustrated all of them, just about.
Well, we can't really keep up, and that's okay. I don't think about this stuff a lot until we actually start to, go back into the book and discuss things like updates and so on. Personally, I mean, I really welcome a lot of the changes. Like most people, I've already learned at my age how to take some of these devices completely for granted. And when they let me down, I become furious. I mean, completely irrational, which is why I have a pile of printers in one corner of the studio, printers that just would not perform the one thing I asked them to do. And there was no conversation going to happen there, obviously. They just were fired. And I went out and bought another one, which apparently is now the way we handle it. But the opportunity to bring some of these new devices, the ones you mentioned, into the book was a great for me, because I do like exploring. I like to get inside things. And as an illustrator, getting inside things and learning from looking and learning from sketching, I'm in a good position then to choose what I would describe as the best point of view, hopefully, from which to show what I've learned, to pass on my, I would say, you know, minimal education about all of these things to someone who's got sort of my level of interest.
Yeah. How do you go, walk us through the process? Because there's text and there are drawings, and it must take a lot of research.
Well, it does, and it also takes a team. This is one of those village things. I mean, there's a writer, there's a technical person, there's an art director. And my role really has been, from the beginning, the visual interpreter of all of this information, which means I need to learn as much from the rest of the team as I can to be able to sensibly reconstruct once we've dismantled the machine, reconstruct it visually so that it makes not only sense to a reader, but so that it's engaging to a reader. And it's getting harder as devices get smaller and more kind of streamlined and you know, smooth and so on. Obviously, you're not being greeted by lots of things to see and things moving. You're just being greeted by a box that, you know, at its best will vibrate for you.
Well, you do. You spend a lot of time, for example, when you take a smartphone apart. There are so many pieces in it, whereas a toilet, it's a couple of pages, but a smartphone, it's got all kinds of parts that you have to explain.
Well, I would rather live without the smartphone than the toilet, so I don't mind giving it that extra that extra space. But the smartphone, I mean, you can only go so far. You take it apart, and what you see are more little blocks, little boxes. And maybe you can pry off one of those little boxes, and you can see underneath it, you know, hundreds of pins. But that's it. You can't really get into the whether it's a processor of some kind or memory chip or whatever. You can't really get into it. So that means that you have to find another way of explaining it and another source of information beyond just your eyes. And so I'm always feeling a little bit of a disadvantage there. And the interesting thing about, you know, getting inside the smartphone was basically seeing the layers of information from the, you know, the screen and down to the main board and where the antennae are. Do you still call them antennae? Okay, yeah.
Antennae, whatever.
I think that if we keep going in the way we're going with technology as it shrinks and shrinks, and if we, for instance, get into nanotechnology and diamonds and graphene and things of that sort, I'm going to have to make a much bigger book. And I don't mean a longer book. I mean a physically bigger book.
Yeah.
The smaller the machines get, the bigger the book is going to have to become, so that when you open up a double-page spread, you're actually looking at what looks like a city, but in fact is this tiny little chip that you can hardly see, or collection of chips on a surface that just look like little blobs, but in fact have all this extraordinary power.
But you haven't lost your sense of humor in the book. I mean, I'll get back to my favorite topic, the toilet tank. There are fish swimming in it, people fishing in the water there. You have a running theme of a woolly mammoth all through the book.
The woolly mammoth, I held on to the woolly mammoth because I introduced the woolly mammoth at the very beginning as a way of helping me get through it. I could not imagine I couldn't even tell how long it was going to take when we started, but the idea of doing 400 pages worth of machines seemed really frightening. I really wondered whether I could maintain the interest. Would they be different enough? Would they be challenging enough? And would I actually finish that first edition in my lifetime? So we started fortunately with simple stuff. We started with levers and inclined planes and ramps and stuff like that. And I went back to cave times desperately looking for some kind of a visual joke or something or style even to get into it that I could then maybe extrapolate through the entire book as the stuff became increasingly more complicated to me, a non-science guy. And the mammoth sort of evolved very naturally in those first sketches and became part of the way of teaching how a lever works by having to be weighed and so on and so forth. This created other problems that other machines could help solve. And I thought at the end of section one, the simple machine section, that would be it for the mammoth. You're on your way, pal. Now we're getting into the pressure and sound and light and all this other stuff. And yet, you know, the team did not feel that way. The team felt, hey, this mammoth is pretty nice. So anyway, the mammoth stayed. Yeah. The mammoth has continued to stay and play its role. But it's still, for me, that kind of fellow sufferer from technology overload, as I am, and I think many people probably are a little bit uncertain of this stuff. And the Mammoth kind of represented that to me, but in a very kind of lighthearted, playful way.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Darlington, South Carolina. Arlie, is that, am I pronouncing it correctly?
You are indeed. Yay, most people, they struggle with it, but if it's close, I answer.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. McCauley, because I was born in the 80s, when a little bit after your book first came out, and my parents raised my siblings and I with your book alongside National Geographic magazine. And it was incredible that even as a young child, I have these memories of, I remember the Mammoth, of being able to understand even from such a young age how things were put together, how one thing affected another. And now as an adult, I work with college-age students who have no idea, sadly, in the majority of cases, just how basic things work. They understand how to operate their smartphone or their tablet or their e-reader or anything so far beyond, you know, what I had when I was their age, but they don't know the foundations that came before it. They don't know how they actually got to that point. So I just wanted to say thank you, because I'm so excited there's a new edition coming out. it will be a wonderful tool to use, because I teach writing, and the amount of writing prompts I'm just envisioning from this book, I'm like, yes, this is good stuff. This is good stuff.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You must be very happy about that, David.
I am very happy about that. Even though I don't do a lot of writing, I don't do a lot of the writing in this book at all. I think of writing and sketching as similar ways of exploring stuff. And if you can write it clearly, and if I can sketch it clearly, then I'm beginning to think that I understand the basic concepts of what it is I'm trying to explain. Only then am I ready to sort of use those words or use those sketches and develop them into the next step, which is to produce an illustration that will not only explain what I've learned and share that with the reader, but also get their attention in the first place. And that's where, you know, all this information is available on the internet. Yeah. You know, it's all there, but it's buried in advertising and, words that hot words and stuff like that, that you can immediately find yourself down a rabbit hole and forget what your original questions were. I think for me personally, having a book that's 400 pages and that hasn't changed length since 1988, even though it has been updated now twice, I think we must have hit the limit sort of magically. But there is that sense of everything you will need to know is in this book. And I think what you need to know, and all you really need to know, is enough to make you curious. I don't pretend, and I don't think any of us pretend, that everything you might want to know about this technology is going to be in this book ever. But if we stimulate, and we just heard that in the conversation from the caller, if I can contribute to the stimulation of curiosity by opening up a few things and having just one or two of them really lodge itself in the memory and mind of a young person, old person even, and it stimulates new curiosity or stirs up, you know, curiosity that's long forgotten, then I think the book makes a contribution. And I guess that's why we've done it again. Mm-hmm. It still seems to be needed.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with David McCauley, illustrator of the Way Things Work Now, his most recent book. The only nit I have, I loved the book. I loved all your books. The only nit I have to pick with something in the book is the Why Airplanes Fly section. You're still using the Bernoulli principle as an explanation, which is a little bit outdated. So
I'll pass that up.
Throwing that out there.
Yeah, no,
one of my pet
pass.
Peeves with everybody who writes about why airplanes fly. So you
we've tried to explain that a couple of times, and in a small book also for a reader for kids about the jet plane. And I would be willing to bet that we made the same.
Well, it's very easy. Wings make the air go down, plane goes up.
Yeah.
Newton's third law.
Yeah.
As an artist, has the act of drawing changed for you with the rise of the tablets or Photoshop? And I know you spend some time in the book showing how printing presses work still.
Right.
I mean...
No, I still draw on paper first. Yeah. That doesn't change. And I draw not only on paper, but the cheapest, crappiest paper you could possibly find. I mean, tracing paper that if I go through 100 sheets of it, has cost me nothing, and which is precisely why I do it. The idea of actually making a beautiful piece of art on a three-ply Bristol board doesn't appeal to me. For me, it's that process of constantly questioning. It's that dialogue with the subject matter that I'm going through, but visually. And I need to work on paper. What I can do now, though, is, for better or worse, is then scan my sort of final sketch and bring in color digitally through Photoshop, and in my case, because it's the only thing I've ever learned how to use marginally. And the reason for that is that I've never been all that confident in my use of color. So if something goes really terribly wrong, I just press a key and it disappears.
Yeah, this is not an e-book. I'm glad to see this is a book you have to read, you know, as a piece of paper, because the illustrations are so wonderful.
I don't think it can be. They get shrunk down, and the whole idea is to have a double-page spread and then maybe a single spread and lead the eye across the surface of this double page spread in a particular way so that the information sticks with the reader. Mm-hmm.
David McCauley, good luck to you. It's a great new book, great update. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
David McCauley is an illustrator of many visual guides to world around us, and this book we're talking about most recently is The Way Things Work Now. One last thing before we go, we bid farewell to Rosetta. Remember Rosetta, the European Space Agency's spacecraft that was the first to orbit a comet? Its lander, Philae, sent detailed images of the icy surface, but ultimately stopped communicating. And the probe's 12-year-long journey came to an end today when the craft was crashed. It was on purpose. It was crashed into 67P, the comet that it was sent to study.
So we'll be listening for the signal from Rosetta for another 24 hours, but we don't expect any. And so this is the end of the Rosetta mission. Thank you and goodbye.
The end of the Rosetta mission, 12 years and a lot of miles. Charles Berkowitz is our director, a senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.